Welcome everybody to episode 8 of Cocktails and Screams. I am John F. Mers, and this is
Christopher Grace.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Tonight we are going to be talking about the 2018 movie Mandy, another visit with Panos Cosmatos.
Yeah, I was wrong that first, because he's only, I thought he did The Void because it's like his kind of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he really just got a special thanks for it.
Oh, okay.
So he's really only made 2 movies.
Oh, wow. So we have a lot to talk about. I'm just going to start things off by saying this movie fucked me up like bad. I watched it last night. I had 3 cocktails over the course of watching this thing, and I feel hungover as shit today. Not just like mentally, spiritually.
Hair of the dog.
Ah, hair of the dog, for real, for real. Chris is going to take us to our cocktail tonight.
Okay, so our cocktail. Since we had a sangria last week, and we were looking for a little red wine, and I really loved that drink from last week.
Yeah, it was good.
And
it was
John good. Mentioned that we should do another one, like a sangria today, you know? And I was like, would Mandy appreciate that? I was like, well, let's kick it up a notch. It is a sangria-based drink. But it's kind of, I've actually created this drink. So blame me, not the internet, not John. Not
Christopher Grace.
Blame me. Blame me and the acid trip that is Mandy. And I'm calling this, well, actually John coined it, the Bloody Mandy. But I'm going to add Bloody Caught on Fire Mandy.
Yeah, so it's a little spooky.
So what we're going to do, we're going to start with our mixer. All right, then we, as usual, are going to put ice in the mixer. I only fill it, it's a mixer glass, only fill it halfway when I'm doing a martini glass. Only do it halfway. Then we start, always start with the alcohol. Fireball, cinnamon, because this is what I call a transition between summer and fall, which I think fall is probably one of my favorite seasons.
It's definitely my favorite.
Cinnamon whiskey fireball is one shot of that, or basically an ounce of that. Then, sangria. I got mine already made. You can make your own. There's plenty of recipes online. It's kind of like a Bloody Mary or a chili on how many different recipes there are. You do 2 ounces of this. 2 ounces or a shot glass that's 3/4 of the way. It's about what an ounce is. All right, 2 ounces of that. Then a 1/2 ounce of apple juice.
Oh.
Because the sangria was already made and I tasted it and it didn't have enough of the, like, the normal steeped in fruit juices, I figured to add some to it. Then 1/2 ounce of no pulp orange juice. All right, and there is 1/2 ounce of grape juice in this, okay, but I'm gonna drop it in afterwards because I like the way the grape juice enters the drink. All right, we're gonna kind of shake that just to mix it around, so you don't have to shake it vigorously. Mandy shakes it enough. All right, then we're gonna pour that in the glass. and I usually go all the way to the top, but like I said, I'm gonna float the grape in there, and I also, because this is kind of like an acid trip, and there's a lot of weirdness in it, and there's fire and craziness, I'm gonna put a dash of Frank's hot sauce. I use Frank's.
Oh, Jesus.
One dash of that. A frozen peach dropped in there. A couple frozen grapes just to keep it nice and cold but spicy. And then here, I'm gonna drop in the grape juice.
Yeah.
See how it moves in there?
Yeah.
Kind of looks like one of the grainy film effects that Panos likes to make. Uh-huh. Cheers.
Cheers.
That's bloody, fiery. Mm. Now, usually I just take the recipe offline, and if I make any augmentations, I just go with it, and I never make it beforehand. I've made this beforehand. It's pretty awesome. Like, for all the crap that goes into it, you think it's going to be this really sweet and stuff, but the cinnamon and the little dash of, you don't think you're going to taste the little dash of Frank. Taste it. It's there.
I have mine in a highball over ice, so.
Then I'm going to slide that over. And we're going to get into
Mandy.
This movie that destroyed
some fucked up
John forever. I'm so glad last week that you picked it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you had enough faith in Panos, his first movie, to say, you know what?
Yeah.
And the guy is steeped in filmmaking. It's just,
and it's, I thought it was interesting that Elijah Wood popped up on the screen there at the start of the movie, and I went, uh-oh.
No, he was the executive producer.
Yeah. So you want to, basic plot of this movie is Nicolas Cage is a logger slash lumberjack and lives.
It's so awesome. It's like it's like this drink. It's just random.
It's just Nick Cage being awesome Nick Cage. I mean, you know, I think we agree that, like, he does some of his finest work when he doesn't talk, and it's just all facial reactions to stuff.
He's perfect. He's got such good his face reads so well.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. So he lives with his wife in the middle of the mountains, and one day she's out for a walk and passes
that house.
Yeah.
That house, like, location scout.
Yeah.
Nailed it with that house.
Yeah. It was,
my God.
Yeah. So she's out walking. She passes a Sean Cassidy type van from the 1970s filled with a bunch of cultists. The leader.
With Panos' version of Charlie Manson.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And when the leader of the cultists desired.
What's the name of the cult?
What's his name there? Jeremiah.
No, the name of his cult was.
Oh, Children of the New Dawn.
And let me tell you something. I fell in love with Panos even more as an artist when he decided to put titles.
Yeah.
Chapter titles on a thing. Yes. And when the chapter title and the music comes up, yeah. And this, it, remember those shirts from the 80s, late 70s and 80s, yeah, that are like iron-on shirts, and they would have letters like, yep, cruising or groovy or whatever, and they would be like these holographic,
yeah,
shiny, like, that's what these titles reminded me of. They're, I want Children of the Dawn, the way it looks on there, on a t-shirt.
Yep.
Just like a 70s style, 80s style t-shirt.
Yep.
Listening, that's Christmas 2020.
2020. So Linus Roach stars as Jeremiah Sand, the leader, the Charles Manson-esque type individual. and he wants Nick Cage's wife, but he can't do it himself. So they hire out, they subcontract the kidnapping out to the the Black Skulls. Is that it?
I think so.
Yeah, a motorcycle gang.
Basically, the motorcycle gang from Weird Science.
Weird Science, Rogue Warrior. You know, one of them. And they come and they kidnap Mandy. No, not really, because the cult sets up shop.
They don't kidnap them. Yeah. They house invade them.
Yeah, they house invade.
House invade them. They knock Red, who was Nicolas Cage, knock him out.
Yeah.
While they're holding them both down, almost like an alien abduction, weirdly enough, how it was shot. It was almost like a weird alien abduction, how they flashed them in and out of strobe lights as they came into their room. And the way that they were looking at each other in their bed with them holding them down was almost like they were being abducted.
Yeah.
But their house got invaded, and, you know, I'll let you continue, because I'm really more interested in how this movie screwed you up from moment to moment.
Well, I'll say it like this. Let me just put this out here for the public record. I have never tried acid. If you know anything about my background with military and national security stuff, I had a security clearance for a very long time.
If you did acid, you couldn't say you did acid.
Well, they would have found it out anyway. So, you know, when you have a security clearance and you keep having to go through reviews, doing drugs is not a good idea. So I have never experienced an acid trip, but this movie...
You did now.
I did now. Because to my mind, this is exactly what an acid trip is.
He took a little dab of that jar of acid goo that he
found. Yeah, in the wasp sting in the neck. Right. This movie starts out real slow. It's like you know, your buddy came up at a nightclub and, hey, man, try one of these. And you put it in your mouth and you start dancing.
It took 40 minutes for it to kick in.
Yeah, 40 minutes for it to kick in. Dang. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Hyper color, hyper everything.
It takes a little bit for this movie to get going. And for a while, you're kind of going, all right, what are we doing here? Yeah. All the while, you're being mesmerized by Panos's choice of coloring, music score, you know, the even the way he shoots it in anamorphic, and it's sneaky. And then
the placement. Can I make a comment about the placement of the lighting?
Yeah, like it's just
like insane. putting a huge red gelled out freaking light attached to the back of the Ford Bronco or whatever Chevy Blazer he's driving through, just so everything behind him is illuminated and huge red saturated stuff as he's barreling down these logger roads.
Again, the cocktail selection tonight absolutely had to be red or some purplish variation thereof, because that is the color scheme of this movie. It's crazy. Yeah,
it's broken up every now and then with other primary colors, but the primary, which is another reason why I'm wearing this red shirt, it's red.
So anyway, jumping back to the plot real quick for those who don't know the movie. So the Black Skulls and Children of the New Dawn move into Nick Cage's house. Jeremiah desperately basically disrobes in front of Nick Cage's wife because he wants to join with her and, you know, obviously have sex. And she laughs at the size of his...
Andrea Riseborough.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
The actress. She's amazing.
Interesting look. But anyway, he can't... well, let's just say he's a little lacking in the downstairs meat department. So...
which is why he needs to be a narcissist, you know, cult leader.
Exactly.
Which, if you didn't know, like they did put that kind of Charlie Manson part of his story of he tried to be a musician.
Yeah.
But in this movie, instead of the Beatles, he wasn't as good as the Carpenters. He's better than the Carpenters, those executives know.
Yeah.
You know, he writes songs about himself that other people sing to him.
So, what do you call it? Nick Cage's wife laughs at the disappointing size of the package, to which
laughs at his little little dick energy.
Yeah. He desperately tries to make something out of nothing. Literally tries to make something out of nothing. And then he gets pissed off, basically goes and stabs. Oh, nice. Goes and stabs Nick Cage in the ribs, in the side of the ribs. That wasn't very nice.
Very stage. Well, he has a God complex, yeah, obviously, and a Christian God complex at that. Right. It's like the triangle is always a symbol. So far, has been a desire symbol for Panos and what he's doing. But in this one, he brings in the cross with the triangle, and they basically reenacted they basically turned Nick Cage into the Christ on the cross,
right?
By putting that spear into his rib, but. Even that, like, instead of the thorns around his forehead, he had barbed wire stuck around his mouth to hold him onto the post.
Yeah, and his arms too. And
his arms were
basically back like this.
Yeah.
Gun show.
Yeah.
So obviously Jeremiah is very upset about this and proceeds to burn Nicolas Cage's wife. In a bag.
Well, I think she was knocked out, but she got unknocked out really fast. She came to in the bag as she
burned. Yeah. Which then sets Nick Cage off on a he escapes
but not before he escapes.
Yeah.
He comes in to watch some weird trippy macaroni and cheese company called Goblin. Video, like there's a commercial on TV when he walks in. He thinks he's watching called Goblin, and there's this goblin feeding kids macaroni and cheese. Yeah. And then he goes into the bathroom, which is probably, for me, is probably one of the best appointed set designs of a bathroom that I've ever seen in a horror movie, except for maybe The Shining when he sees the dagger. And he goes in there and he, by the power of, I think, vodka, he gets the rage.
I
that was one of my favorite scenes.
He walks into the bathroom, and I'm like, okay, we're obviously not in the house. It looks nothing like the rest of the house. It looks like a soundstage. And it's jarring just in its appearance alone. But then apparently
he shoots it on a wide angle.
Yeah. Apparently, Nick Cage stores his vodka in the bathroom, so...
He hides it in there. His character hides it in there because maybe his wife thinks he has a drinking problem.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, it's a pretty fucking trip.
And there's some toilet drinking.
Yeah, it's...
He's in his tidy whities the whole time.
Yeah, that was a little... Yeah, I didn't need to see that.
What else was amazing about that scene? Oh, yeah. Nick Cage is acting. Like... Everybody sees Nick Cage is like, yeah, he usually has this zany, like, intensity, and he's, like, really big. But then when you really think of what had just happened to him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think that scene should have, I know it's this horror movie, and I know the it should have at least have been a Spirit Award.
Oh, yeah.
But to me, Nick Cage's acting, especially in that scene, but in a lot of other scenes, especially his ability to act without saying words.
Yeah.
And to express, like, to me, that scene, after everything that happened up to that point, and the love that was... See, that's the thing is about with this movie with Panos is, like you said, the beginning of this movie, you kind of are lulled into this false sense of security. Right. But in that time, Panos really creates chemistry between these two characters. Yeah. You know, you can tell they love each other.
Yeah.
Where it's been a long time since I've seen Nick Cage that believable in a love interest on screen.
Yeah.
Maybe Family Man or something like that, or... One of those types.
I think Family Man's a fair estimate for that.
What's the one where was Family Man the one where he it's kind of like where he wakes up and his wife's different?
Yeah, Tio Leone. Yeah.
Yeah. But then that scene, like I was thinking, oh, here, you know, when I first watched it, I was like, oh, this is Nick Cage doing Nick Cage again, another director that can't put his thumb on him and say, I know your ability to act.
Right.
I know you have control over your instrument. You need to have control over your instrument. But then it keeps going, and then you really, when he breaks down on the toilet, and then he come, and then it snaps in. Like you see the focus,
yeah,
of rage,
yeah,
the focus, the rage that he's dealing with,
yeah,
the chaotic rage that he's dealing with, and what had just happened clicks, and yep. there's this razor sharp focus to his rage, and that scene to me nailed the interest in the rest of the movie. At that point, I was like, however zany it got after that, yeah, however acid-y trip, like,
yeah, and it does,
downward spiral,
right,
living with goblins that are trying to take advantage of you, weird doctors making acid in a subterranean, whatever, I was in. I was like, yeah, you got me, you know?
Yeah, because he goes from the toilet from the bathroom to the forge, where he creates this.
He has an Iron Man moment, man.
He has an Iron Man moment, but
instead of building his iron suit, he's like, I'm going to build this fantasy kind of like Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, it's like that Klingon double.
It's a slang tool.
Yeah,
it's a Swiss Army slang tool, but you don't have to pull each blade out. They're just already there, ready for you.
But he's not done.
No, and it's shiny. A little bit more. It's like shiny chrome.
So
like Flight of the Navigator chrome.
Where does he go? He goes to his buddy Carruthers, who, yes, is played by Bill
Duke.
The man. And when he shows up on screen, I was like, holy shit, it's Bill Duke.
I don't know who you are out in the world, but you give us away one more time, I'll bleed you real bad and leave you out here.
You're ghosting us, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And also from
Bill Duke, man. He's
fucking Commando fame. The Green Beret is going to eat you.
Commando, Predator.
Everything. Just everything.
The dude has not had a bad performance in his life. And then to just put him, to put him in a trailer in the middle of bumfuck nowhere.
You have no idea.
Where is this taking place? I think Alaska.
I don't know. I thought Canadian.
Canada. Well, Panos is Canadian.
Right.
So it definitely has. That's what I like about, like, this is a sophomore movie. It's the only movie. He hasn't made another movie since.
Yeah. It's just,
there's no movie represented that he's making right now.
It's just a crazy fucking movie. So he goes to Bill Duke's trailer in the middle of nowhere to get the Reaper, which is his crossbow, and, you know, just kind of takes it out of storage because I guess Bill Duke has been hanging on to it for him. I don't know. Maybe it was a rental for lease with an option to buy. I don't know.
And on the door it says, fuck off.
Yeah.
And he knocks on the door. He's like, can't you read? You know?
Like, Bill Duke is literally on screen for maybe 5 to 7 minutes and just.
And you remember him.
Yeah, he just owns the fucking camera.
Well, if it wasn't for him, there would be no exposition on who the bikers are. Right. I don't know if it was a nod to the scene from True Romance where you have really strong, huge, strong actors sharing a trailer together.
Yeah.
Basically building the exposition that would launch you into the rest of the film.
Yeah.
But it kind of had that vibe of Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper.
Dennis Hopper,
from
yeah.
that movie where they're in the pattern of dialogue,
yeah.
You get so much information,
yeah.
And it's not boring.
Right. Right.
It's not like you're reading from the textbook of the story that we're trying to tell. You're actually in the cadence and Bill Duke's voice when he's speaking, and oh man.
Yeah. It's just a great, it's a great, great fucking scene. It is.
It's full of ridiculously good scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. But as soon as he pops up on screen, I was like, wow, Bill Duke! Like, what? Fucking great. So Bill Duke gives Nick Cage some intel on the Black Skulls and Children of the New Dawn and all that good happy horse shit. And then just kind of let Nick Cage go and do Nick Cage type stuff.
Well, yeah, that was when I first watched this. I watched it in a theater and I was like, yeah, that was kind of this continual thing, like Nick Cage doing Nick Cage. Because up until that point, he's in a explorative, I'm being very nice right now, an explorative acting realm of working with just people that he jives with.
Yeah.
And not all of them are good filmmakers.
Right.
They might ultimately become good storytellers, like marriages that he worked with in Shadow of the Vampire, which was one of the last movies he produced through Saturn Films that he collaborated with and said got a good movie out of it.
Yeah.
But rewatching it, I've seen this now like 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
On every additional viewing that I see this movie, the more and more I look at this as one of Nicolas Cage's strongest acting performances.
I don't think there's
only one or two times that I think he falls into that caricature of his abilities.
Yeah.
The rest is almost like he's really taken this movie and the plot and what I guess Panos is giving him.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure at this point in his career, and he's worked with so many huge directors, he knows, I call it actors who, they just know where their mark is. And after they know where their mark is, they just be themselves. Like Nick Cage, I know where my mark is, tell me the lines, and get out of my way.
Yep.
Where this one, it seems like, thank you for telling me where my mark is. Thank you for that line note. Anything else you might want me to do? Is like, just try one without saying anything, Nick. You know, I don't know if that's what he's telling him, but it seems like this is a Nicolas Cage who's actually trying to take control over the tool.
Yeah.
That I think for almost a decade and a half, since I think he became most people think that he's hard up on money, but he's not. He's got plenty of it, which is why he makes the decisions he makes and does what he does. He's just doing movies that he looks at and says, this is awesome. But with, I hope, this is my hope, him and Panos continue to collaborate.
Yeah.
Whether it's just producing or whatever.
No, I want to see another Nick Cage, Panos Cosmatos hookup for sure, because the way Panos, like you said, gets a handle on Nick Cage, directs him, points him in the direction to go, and then Nick Cage just does his thing, and it's like a laser focused Nick Cage. His performances are tangible. Like you feel like you could reach through the screen and just feel what he's feeling. He does such an amazing job.
Especially if you're an actor. If you're in the actor world and you've been in any, whether it's high-end acting or just regardless of what it is, any set that has some level of monicum of professionalism.
Right.
Whether it's really unprofessional, but they're still trying to make it work, to everything is like a Swiss watch. As an actor or has been involved in those things, you really start to see an actual crafting going on.
Yeah.
Which is why, bringing me back to that scene I call it the aftermath scene.
Right.
Where it's just, like, I wish, those are those moments, I look at film and certain scenes, and as a aspiring filmmaker, I go, I wish I was on set that day.
Just to see how...
Because there is another side of that set. There's another side of that door that he walks into.
Right.
Okay? And when the door opens and he walks in and the door closes, you know the camera's running. You know that there's directions that have been given.
Right.
Whether there are a lot of directions or a little directions, whether you trust your actor or you don't trust your actor, whether you're trying to move the actor into some moment that they could have in that scene. But the fly on the wall that's inside me all the time, looking at movies, going, I wish that I was there outside that door to see the preparation that went into before that door opened.
Yeah.
Because I've seen thousands and thousands of movies and scenes where the door opens and the actor is there and they have to perform on their own. There's no one else in the room.
Yep.
And it's just them. And it's that heavy of a scene.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of work. That's exhausting. It's exhausting to make a movie. It's even more exhausting as an actor to put that kind of performance.
Right.
So when you see Nick Cage doing Nick Cage stuff, that's not easy.
No.
It's not easy.
When I said that, I don't mean that.
To him, and people see it, so they think it's just this thing that, but that scene, it is not easy to go, no. And not in all of the actors in this movie, like the constant level of intensity from every performance in this movie is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. When I say Nick Cage doing Nick Cage stuff, I don't mean it as an insult.
No, I know.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying, I feel like Nick Cage is one of those actors who, when he is in his zone, as he is in this movie, it looks, there's a degree of effortlessness to it.
That's when it's good.
That's exactly. That's what makes it so good, you know. And I agree. I would have.
But then compare that scene to the scene where they're laying in the bed and she's telling them a story, and you're seeing them fall in love on screen.
Yeah, yeah. It was
good. Like, there's a moment.
Yeah.
When he comes home and she's working on her art.
Yeah.
That any other actor, whatever the scene is, but he stays there over the easel.
Yeah.
And really observes, and then observes her observing her work.
Yeah.
And there's like just little moments where you're going, this guy is just doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there was an action there somewhere.
Yep.
And then he started doing it. And then you start going, he doesn't hear action anymore.
No.
He just does it.
The closest
thing we do, okay, let's go do this.
The closest thing I can kind of equate, at least in terms of my own personal experience, is the scene that I did in the miniseries The Cars That Made America, when I give a speech, and it's about a minute and a half long. I'm up at a podium and I have to address a crowd of reporters.
Yeah.
And that's just like, I don't really interact with anybody until the end of that scene. And I had to do that. It took 36 takes.
Wow.
Not because of my performance, fortunately.
Exhausting.
But because of everything else that they were trying to shoot. They were shooting from different angles. They didn't like the light bulb. It takes place back in the 40s and the 50s.
So there's a lot of tweaking for everything from wardrobe to background to, yeah.
Well, the reporters were firing off their old-fashioned cameras, so they had to replace the light bulbs. They didn't like how the extras were firing off their cameras. So I had to literally give this speech 36 times. I came home and fell asleep. It was an exhausting. Don't get me wrong. I loved it. I loved every minute of it. But it was exhausting.
You understand what I'm saying? It's exhausting.
It's exhausting, yeah. And all I could think when I'm watching this movie, and especially that scene that we're talking about, is, my God, how many times did they have to do this? They had to do this
hopefully, this is why I'm saying I wish I was there, because part of me, I'm hoping that I'm seeing a master at work, two masters at work.
Yeah.
The director and writer and Panos, who knows his vision beyond a shadow of a doubt, and Nick Cage, who met Panos and is like, I got to work with you.
Yeah.
That movie, your first movie was fucking amazing.
Right.
You know what you're doing. I've worked with so many people. You know what you're doing. We have to work together. And when we do, it's going to be magic. And I'm hoping that they got through that door and it was a one take.
That'd be beautiful.
Did all of that. Like, I pray for those moments.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
you're watching, I call like stars being reborn. Like,
yeah.
I saw that scene. I was like, Nick Cage as a star just got reborn.
Yeah.
And, but the thing is, he's doing it in material that if you were a young actor, you're trying to impress a future studio exec, like, I'm trying to work in this scene
right.
so that somebody might give me a higher profile job so
right,
that I
yeah.
can get out of poverty or whatever. But he's like, all that's gone.
He's just doing that.
It now as a love of acting.
Yeah, so, he's done all that stuff.
But then you're
yeah.
like, I bet when you fell on the bed, John,
yeah,
you were like, that's the most fun I've ever had.
Oh yeah, I absolutely loved it. I mean, before I got home and collapsed from exhaustion, I was on a complete freaking high.
Your
it was incredible.
Stop. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the acting bug. That's what people get. That's the charge that they get out of that when you can become somebody else. I mean, completely and totally. And that's what we see in this movie with Nick Cage. It's just this metamorphosis, you know. And the best part of this is because, you know, you see a lot of movies where revenge is the central theme, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to buy into with a lot of them because it just feels like it's by the numbers. But exactly what you're talking about, how they fall in love on screen, you know, like, this feels legit.
You believe the revenge.
Believe the revenge. It feels
you're like he could do anything
yeah.
to these people.
Yeah. Totally.
As he can make it, he can drop a Wile E. Coyote cartoon anvil on their head, and you'd be like, "I believe it."
And not only
I'm going to believe everything he does to them.
Yeah, I mean, not
how
only
she looks at him, how he looks at her, and that's the other thing. Like you can't take away from Andrea Riseborough's performance either, because she's. Her ability to have this, because when she laughs at the cult leader,
yeah,
who isn't a slouch actor either.
No,
Steven Spielberg found him from the Taken series.
You
believe her ability to not buy the bullshit,
right?
Too. Like, even through all the acid that they and insect venom that they just pumped through her body, she's still able to see through all the bullshit.
Yep.
Because up to that point, you saw her as this kind of dark leveling force, to where there's enough darkness in her vision, like she with like the Black Sabbath T-shirts and.
Right.
And the art with the
the novel, and you know
the fact that the panels breaks into her art as cartoon, yeah. as anime,
yeah,
is another example of amazing like video drone type connections and things like that. So, yeah, but you believe her, and you like so every scene she's in, you believe everything that she's doing. You know, there's just really not an actor that you're watching. Even the little act, even the smaller roles of the Children of Dawn, you believe them.
Well, Ned Dennehy's great as Brother Swan, who's sort of like Jeremiah's, you know, right-hand guy.
Yep.
And then
Richard Burke is the chemist.
Yep. And then
he's the only one talking, really.
Yeah.
Nick Cage is observing.
Yep. And then you got Linnea Paulette as Sister Lucy.
Yep.
You know, sort of the sexual.
She's the Midsummer, the innocent.
Yeah. Yeah.
The innocent that is in a bastardized environment. But yet, for some reason, even in her ignorant belief, it's still some sort of innocence to her,
mm-hmm.
which is even portrayed in the end when Nick, when Red allows her to go.
Yeah.
And I almost, I had, like, when I first saw it, I almost thought that when he got into that station wagon and he was driving down that, that log road, and he was having the mental flashback of his, of his love riding with him,
yeah,
of Mandy riding with him, and everything saturated in red. He's covered in blood. The inside of the car looks like it's covered in blood. She's in this kind of amberish red color on her side of the passenger seat as she's smoking her cigarette casually. I was almost thinking that as he turned back to observe the road from the perspective of Mandy, that the innocent girl that he let go wasn't gonna like let him go.
Oh yeah, yeah. Hey, we gotta take a break real quick. We'll be right back. All right. We're back. All right.
Boom, boom.
All right, so you said you saw this in the theater.
Yes, I did.
Wow. All right. That's pretty cool. Because it was only played at 250 theaters, which is interesting. So what was the budget? What was the budget on this movie?
$6 million.
Hmm. I noticed that it was Legion M.
It was XYZ. I got a kind of like a, I've only talked to him like literally three times in my life, but I'd say we have a cordial, communicative kind of. We haven't collaborated yet because I guess I'm not Panos yet. I think I have a Mandy in me. I think I don't really see, that's the thing is like his company XY, Nick Bulletin company XYZ, is doing films like these and other kind of horror, like reestablishing strong, auteur filmmakers in the horror genre, throwing, you know, $3 to $5 million at them and getting these movies. But I think I have a, like I said last week, or forget which show it was, I don't think I will ever go back into the horror genre unless I have the ability to do it the way I see it.
Yeah.
And not pull any punches and really have a team that understands how to build the world.
Right.
Like, obviously, Panos collaborates with people that know how to do that.
Right.
And I, you know, like we said, money can only get a certain team assembled.
Right.
If you wanted the Avengers of horror, the Avengers, if you want to put an Avengers team together to go out in the field and do something, you see, like, people with, like, The Devil's Backbone last week and this one and other films that are just getting so much, squeezing so much atmosphere out of the dollar.
Yeah.
I think I have, but that's what it would take. Like, it would have to take, like, I know my short list, and I know what their day rate is, or I know the kind of material they need to get involved, and what they're willing to do, and there is a break level on financing. Okay. And the financing has to meet a certain level.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, we're only, like, there's people out there, I'm only getting involved if there's this much equity, or this much, if there's this much money already in bonded in the bank.
Right.
You know.
So what did this take home?
What did it take home?
Yeah, well, what did it do?
Well, it only grossed, it's saying that it only grossed $1.5 million worldwide.
Hmm.
But that was theatrical.
Yeah, yeah.
This thing exploded after the fact.
When it hit VOD?
So when it hit VOD and the word of mouth, because it, like you said, it was a limited release.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't have that broad of a release. Maybe at the peak of its, a couple weeks after it released, it probably had a peak of 800-900 theaters.
Yeah.
you know, and these are all art house level cinema theaters. You know, they're not major like AMC. I don't think right. AMC showed it. I don't think Showcase showed it. I'm pretty sure if they did show in any Redmond, what's his name? What's their company? Landmark.
Yep.
Then it was limited in there because they only have a few. Landmark still has a few theaters that they consider art house. I remember when Landmark was art house. Like everything they did was, you know. So, but given it probably didn't stay. I don't know. I mean, I can look. It stayed in theaters from September 13th, 2018. It stayed in theaters 53 days.
Yeah.
Now, that's a good run.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was only in 5 theaters at that time, right? The last day it was in theaters, it was in 5 theaters, and it only made $188. Most filmmakers don't make that in their career. But it puts things into perspective that when it opened, it was ranked 12th in the release of all films of that day.
Yeah.
12th. And it was only in 250 theaters. So it had a viewership, right? It had a viewership. It made $131,000 in its first day over 250 theaters. So to average $525 a theater, $525 in the theater per theater. I don't know why it didn't. Well, let's be serious. The reason why it didn't get a wide release, it should have given those numbers. It should have went probably from 250 to 800.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't. It didn't go past 250. It didn't release so it steadily went down. It dropped into the 25 percentile after the third week. So
I think we should also give, I mean, you've mentioned, you know, the ensemble cast, but I mean, Linus Roach, I know him most especially from Law and Order SVU.
Yep.
As the executive, the assistant DA.
Yeah.
So, you know, to see him in a role like this as Jeremiah Sand was just, I didn't even recognize
him. I was introduced to him through the Taken series, which I brought up during the Fourth Kind, and he played the alien.
Yeah.
And like, you were like, where's this guy been?
Yeah.
Who has that much control over their tool, their acting tool? Like, this guy looks like he's been acting his whole life. Maybe he had. Maybe it took that long for him to get a Steven Spielberg gig.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen him in a bad performance ever.
Yeah.
I mean, he's always playing the supporting role.
Yep.
But that's the point, is good, really good leading actors. You put them around really good supporting actors, it becomes kind of a competition.
Yeah.
And if you're in a scene with somebody who is just giving it to you, you don't want to get upstaged. You don't want to let that happen. So, yeah, he's like I said, when I saw him been taken, I was taken. I was like, this guy's to be taken seriously as an actor.
Yep. So. It's an amazing movie. It really and truly is. I mean, we're not going to spoil
the end. It's a film, but that's the other thing, that it wasn't shot on film, but all of his films have film grain processing used in what's in the vision that he's trying to create. There is a process. What's it called? I don't know why I keep bringing Spielberg up, but I remember him saying something like there's a thing of when it's the tangibility. And that's another thing that I think the resurgence of the last 5 years of these horror movies that have this tangible nature to them, or this nostalgic nature to them, this ultraviolet neon smoke, I guess, to it. Like Spielberg said, film is like, even when you're on a still life, it's still running through the camera, and the grain on the celluloid swims. So even when there's nothing moving in the frame, the mind eye watching can see it moving.
Yeah.
There's constant movement. And then when you play with light in that aspect, which Panos is a master at playing with light, overlaying images over images, the way he overlaid Andrea's face over the top of Linus's face during the acid trip, subtly. That wouldn't have been as subtle if it was still being seen through the eye of a digital camera. But because there was processes going on, it created this nice round muddiness to the edges, and it works because there is this constant movement of a film, a tangible film process that I hope continues its research, there continues that nostalgic understanding that young filmmakers or filmmakers in general, even if they can't work using celluloid or using film, they can still understand that there is a method on why, or that there's actual psychological connection between a viewer and what's that celluloid tangible film does to a viewer, which in this case, if you're looking at an acid trip, you really don't want to see where the edges are. Everything blurs together.
Right.
You don't want even, like you were saying, to use an anamorphic, so all the light is drawn out and linear. But even with that, there's still a blend to it. There's a blending to everything that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell that he's doing overlays of, like, there's the end scene where he's driving out down the thing. You see this kind of kaleidoscopic use of red, green, blue, and yellow as this car's driving, and you can see that it's almost painted on the frame.
Yeah.
And then it pans up, and there's this weird cosmic landscape that is obviously representative of Mandy's art, of being the last frame of the movie. But all of that blending doesn't happen without, like, some sort of nostalgic, tangible hearkening back to something that is real.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get over how good this writer filmmaker is at capturing that understanding.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. You might not, all of this stuff, it is out there. It is wild. It's hard to watch it. You have to be a certain kind of nut to watch it subjectively, like us, for art's perspective. But I really don't see very many filmmakers right now, even the giants to this day, that still has that kind of control over the frame of what's happening in it. From probably the action to cut, to getting into post-production and determining how things move and how much pacing in between each dissolve and the timing, like drawing out the timing, why, like the fact that they waited towards the end to show the initial introduction of their relationship. Like, I met her in a bar.
Right.
Like, that's that, that kind of stuff is like French New Wave, Breathless kind of stuff. That's like Godard type stuff, yeah, where you're basically going, these are real people. Like, he didn't need that scene. But throwing that scene in there and having that scene where he's looking at her turn into the scene of them in the car where he's covered in blood and he sees her almost like the way he wants to remember her.
Yeah.
Like, when you're so confronted with film on a regular basis, you witness certain things that happen. You're like, oh, there's more going on here. There's an actual artist at the wheel.
You know,
instead of just, we're trying to make a buck. So, I mean, yeah, he didn't make the $6 million back in the theaters, but I'm pretty sure.
It would be interesting to know.
I'm pretty sure maybe the reason why he hasn't done something yet and why it's taken so long is because he's getting ready to have his Pan's Labyrinth. He's getting ready to have his opportunity where there is a interest, there is enough people with enough money and opportunity and 4,000 theater access that is willing to say, let's make a rated R Panos movie and release it to 4,000 theaters and let's give him what he wants. And but with the understanding that there's going to be a certain level of craft to it. That we're not just dealing with somebody who pulled the wool over eyes for two films in a row that has no understanding of the path that filmmaking has gone.
No, I mean, he clearly, I definitely think
he studied filmmaking, and it shows in everything that he does.
Yeah,
like every nostalgia. Like I was like when I saw the bikers and the way they looked, I was like, I guess. 11 or 12 again watching Weird Science or the first time I saw Mad Max or
yeah, I mean it, he's clearly due for that hop up to the next level in terms of financing, I think, because
you know what I wish he would do, not it's similar to what Waititi did with Ragnarok for Thor Ragnarok. I wish Marvel would give him one of their darkest stories.
Finish that thought for me.
What was the thought?
What you wish he would do with Tiki?
I wish that, like you said, if he's going to springboard off, like, or to get his due, I think a group of collaborators or studios, if you want to call Marvel, it is a studio, but I think it's bigger than that. Give him one of their, like the Dark Avengers, or
that'd be really cool.
Give him one of the darkest material.
Yeah, like, you know what would be what might be good for that would be like, I know it's already probably, I think it's in the process right now. Cloak and Dagger was kind of that dark. I'd like to see that, or I like Doctor Strange when it came out, but I feel like Doctor Strange would be a great thing for Panos to take a stab at.
That's what I was going to say, Doctor. You might think it's a little weird, and they've been trying to make it for a while, and I think it would be a big deal for both of them, and it would be out of left field, but I think given what's at the core of these movies is Treasures. Him and Nick Cage...
Yeah.
Does the third installment to what is it? The American or what's Nick's Disney?
National Treasure.
National Treasures.
Yeah. Sorry, I was trying to remember the model called Treasures.
Go a little Angels and Demons. Go a little brown kind of like Da Vinci Code kind of dark kind of aspect, but have. Get really deep in the because he's already doing it. Like, get deep in the Illuminati side of American Treasures.
I'd almost, I'd almost say send him down H.P. Lovecraft's way and let him tackle some Cthulhu stuff, because that would be like mind flayer shit. I mean, this is right up Panos's alley. I mean, can you imagine if he did a Cthulhu movie and he's just sitting there like, the elder ones have already infected my brain. I'm done. I'm just,
yeah.
I'm...
He's probably the only one that can handle that material for the modern day.
Yeah.
To imagine a Panos new audience, to get new audience for that kind of story.
It'd be incredible. Can you imagine him handling? I mean, it's already in production, but the Mountains of Madness. You imagine Panos doing that? That'd be, oh my God, it's like a natural.
Even the name fits him.
Oh, it'd just be incredible. I mean, it needs to happen, because we've seen two of his movies now, and
they're dripping. Yeah,
man, it's just like, I want a third movie that I can put on, having experienced the first two, and know, okay, I'm in for a ride. Like, just buckle up. Close the door, pull shades down, and just...
What about a series?
Like, yeah.
That's something I would like to connect him to, a series that you know are going to have like 3 or 4 seasons, and each hour episode is like him getting to make an hour movie. Can you imagine? Like, talk about shutting the doors and close. Like, don't talk to me. It's like, I'm doing a binge. It's like, the new season's out, I'm doing a binge. You know? Like, imagine Panos directing all of the next season, or the fourth season of Ozark, or some shit like that.
He's got it now. We got to get him a vehicle that's just, that lets him play, you know, that just, because I'm just so impressed with it, with everything this guy does, you know.
Like True Detectives, like not the second season, but the first season. Similar, like that kind of, like, world building, where you have these detectives that are kind of like the Seven type, like a Seven-esque type movie kind of feel, David Fincher kind of feel, and then you throw him into that world, and then you have Nick Cage as one of the detectives.
who doesn't say very much. He just fucking...
It doesn't speak. He just... Everything's happening to him. Him happening to it.
I love that. Like, all right, so we gotta, you know what? We should reach out to him. I tagged him, and when we did Beyond the Black Rainbow, I tagged him on Twitter, but he's not on Twitter all that much. But man, I'd love to do
it. I asked him if he wanted to be on the show.
What's that? Yeah.
I asked him if he wanted to be on Cocktails and Screams.
Tonight or
beneath? No, just in general. You know, whenever you're gonna go back on, and because he's done a couple little podcasts, little things that people have done and done interviews. So, like, it's not like he's this unapproachable being.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I was like, if he does something else, I already put it out there. It's like, hey, you do something else.
I say we send him a link to this.
I say we create a third block where he can put any logo he wants or face that he wants to put up there.
No, seriously, I'm going to send him this link and just be like, hey, we're talking about your... Another one of your awesome.
Not just blowing smoke up your ass. We're blown away.
Yeah.
There's not enough Panos frames out there.
There are not enough. I want another adventure with Panos. Honest to God.
Like, I took 5 or 6 last night when we're rewatching. I was like, I got to take 5 or 6 of these images, because I'm blowing them up and putting them on my wall.
Absolutely. And they're
paintings, you know.
Can you imagine somebody walking into your office like the images that you were...
Like the image of Nick Cage all bloody inside the
car. All bloody and stuff.
Staring over with befuddled love, like, how'd you get back into my car? I thought they killed you in a fire. Like, that kind of like that image. And then have her on the adjoining wall.
Yeah.
Looking back at him. And then whoever's in the office is sitting there between these...
Between the two of them.
And everything else is monochrome, like it's just white. Everything else in the room's white, but these two darkly red images look.
Oh, it's a very Valentine's Day theme, you know. It's just... Oh man, so Mandy, I just, what a trip! What an absolute trip, and it was a fun one.
So how many drinks you thinking?
Oh man.
Is it too early to talk about drinks, or
no? We're good. I don't know, because, you know, I turned it off last night and I had three cocktails and I was like,
after or during?
No, during.
And then you turned it off and had three more.
No, I turned it off and went to bed. I was like, I don't even know what I just watched.
Did you have any dreams?
Yeah, I had some pretty weird, wacky dreams last night. You know, and then in retrospect and thinking about it all day today in preparation for this, it was, between Beyond the Black Rainbow and Mandy, you know, obviously the world has an amazingly talented filmmaker here.
Yeah.
And I'm like a solid 8.5 on this. Yeah.
That's where I am. Eight and a half.
Fueled by Nick Cage's performance, you know, and then laser focused by Panos, and then supported by an ensemble cast that's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just crazy good. Yeah, I loved it. I had a great time with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Eight and a half. I was not inebriated or under the influence whatsoever when I first went to watch this movie. I had, however, seen Beyond the Black Rainbow many times.
Okay.
Like studying frames, kind of watching it, like pause that, trying to figure out, like, you know, and then rewinding and go, why did he edit that way? Does this music work? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I knew going in, and the way he titles his movie has been through a film process.
Hmm.
So when you see the red titles with the font, there's no separation. It's like you see the edge of the font.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't make out where the blackness on the screen and the end of that red font. And then you come and you see strip mining going on and logging and a landscape, and then a Nick Cage and the kind of in the blue zone of kind of like in the dawn or just the blue light of dawn or of dusk with his using his chainsaw, and you're going, this is different. Mm-hmm. And but yet has the same tone. There's still, it's like a weird Panos pacing that's happening.
Yeah,
where there's instantly pulling you in to, how do we start this movie?
Yeah. Let me ask you something real quick, because you brought up the beginning of the movie, and I saw something last night. First of all, I want to say this in relation to hiding the vodka in the bathroom, because you brought up a good point that maybe his wife didn't want him drinking. There's that point on the helicopter when they're leaving the work site where the guy
says like this,
and he just kind of waves it off. Yeah, but that scene right there. Now again, I don't know if it was. You know, I rented this on Amazon Prime, so I didn't know whether it was just the resolution on the screen of my TV or what. But there was noise in the air of that helicopter scene, right?
Yeah, so okay. I'm glad you bring, like, that's what I'm talking about. What, regardless of what he shoots on, there is a post-production process that's going on,
yeah,
where there is a muddying,
yeah, gritty
of the frame,
yeah,
but in a way that color, light, and darkness is hugely being represented and taken seriously.
Yeah.
They're also I don't know how much it's noticed, but there's definitely a, like you said before, there's definitely kind of this realization that there is a master working And it's very rare to, like, these days to see that because everything has kind of this pop to it.
Right.
But even his use of music to pull in and out or internally into, and he's making the audience do what he wants. There's not a moment where you're in any of either one of these films where you're trying to suss out or you're trying to portray your vision of where this is going.
Yeah.
Because you're really pulled in from the moment you open the titles come on, a music starts, and that music is, even the music is forcing nostalgia in the viewer's brain.
Yep.
It's not a song you've ever heard before because it was made specifically for that movie.
Right.
But it has a tangibleness that we recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, like taking a bite out of an apple. You don't have to have had an apple for a decade. You know what the sound's going to sound like.
Yeah.
If it's a ripe apple, you know what it's going to sound like. You know what crushing through that membrane is going to feel like. You know what the sweetness is going to taste like. There's going to be a granulization. Even if it's a crispy Granny Smith, there's still going to be this noticeable reality that you're being, that you're experiencing. And it's very, very difficult. And I don't think people give enough credit. It's very difficult to even come close to being able to do that, especially when you're bombarded with almost a too precise version of filmmaking to where it's almost robotic to this point. You know, there's just no room. The fact that he takes that amount of care in post-production to play with the art again. Like, you write the story, you're playing with the art.
Yeah.
You go into pre-production and principal photography, you're playing with the art. And then you go into post-production, you're like, how can I play with this art anymore to actually add depth? And it's not like I'm just playing with it because, you know, he's like, he's Pollock. He drops, it just fell off of my brush and onto the ground. And that's new. And no one's done it before. Okay, well, let's extrapolate on that. And so you start realizing that you're dealing with an artist that uses light and moving imagery and sound and the idea of what cinema represents to an audience that hasn't seen this before, but for some reason it's a tune they recognize.
Right. Like, yeah.
I've heard that.
I think that's really well put. Do you think most of this happens in post, or is he playing around with gels during principal photography? Is he messing with lighting, or, you know, when does most of the, I guess my question is, when does most of the magic happen? Because we know what the movies, these two movies look like when we see them, but when is he realizing that vision, so to speak?
I don't know. I can only go from like things that I've, how I've sussed out certain visual, kind of cinematic epiphanies, I guess.
Yeah.
Like creative epiphanies. Like when you know, when, and like I mentioned before, I think that there's only three or four times where I've done something visually and I'm like, I haven't seen that before.
Okay.
And I've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of movies and I haven't seen that before. And it's in those processes, I sometimes it happens walking down the street 10 years before you're on in post-production having an idea, you, it just harkens back.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a pin or a feather in a cap that says, I know exactly when and where or what kind of scene I'm going to be in to use this kind of artistry.
Right,
this kind of pacing or this kind of song, or you hear a song and you're like, I know exactly
that
this
yeah.
song could open this type of movie. This yeah. song could guarantee a, this song can guarantee an audience of such a cross section of Americans or international viewers to fall in love with whoever there's on the screen listening to. All I have to do is put them next to each other, have them appear to be gazing in each other's eyes, and play this song.
Got it.
Or wrap them in this kind of light. Or do, like you kind of get these kind of creative epiphanies that you kind of go, oh. And sometimes it's fully well-rounded, and you know exactly where to put it. You know what genre it'll fit the best in. But it's any, like seeing art on the wall and being like, that would be a good backdrop for this kind of a movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just going in to buildings you've never been in before and seeing architecture and going, the theme that, or the emotion and the theme that this architecture is giving me, I could use in this kind of situation, which doesn't make any sense at the time. And you haven't seen it before, but for some reason it, like, you know,
like, well, I think that rings true.
I don't know if he's doing it that way.
But I would think that that rings true. It definitely rings true to me, because when I write books, I'll hear a song and something will click and be like, I need to be playing that song when I'm writing this scene.
Yeah.
In
over and over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. Or I'll see a painting and it'll spark something. Yeah. So I think your point rings true to probably to most creative people, I would think. I mean, we're always sort of looking at stuff and saying, even if I can't use that right now, I'm cataloging that and putting it away for later, because sooner or later I'm going to pull it down and use it. So
interesting. Like meeting somebody that you never met before at a coffee shop and then having a 5-minute conversation with them. But for some reason, 5 years down the road, that you're writing a scene or you're writing a storyline. And something that person who you've never met before and you never met again, you thought it was just this toss-off conversation, revisits you as a creative.
Yeah.
And says, now's the time. And you're bringing it up. You're like, I remember having a conversation with this individual. Yeah. This is the story they told me, and it's directly correlated to what I'm trying to accomplish here.
Yeah.
And it just, it's weird. It just, like, plugs in, like, the perfect jigsaw puzzle.
Those moments are incredible, because that's exactly what it's, right, it just fits nice and neatly. That's where that goes.
That's why I met that individual, I guess, you know.
Yeah Interesting. Well, we are just about out of time. What's the next movie we're doing? Are we doing
I have a couple of them that I thought about doing.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, should we?
We had a suggestion.
We had a suggestion, but I'm thinking, given the last couple that we've had.
Yeah.
I feel like I feel like doing more non-studio esque type things. Because I think that we, the two of us, and whoever is listening, is actually getting more out of it than the taste of popcorn. And I was thinking about saving this for the next one, but the next time I choose, because it's a lot, and like, I know you're probably gonna have to watch it, because I don't know, it's between two.
Okay.
You mentioned the other day as kind of an example that you're like, I'm going to make a werewolf movie, but I need to do it in a way that's like, so there's two werewolf or beast type movies.
Right.
One is more mainstream. The other one is a French film. One's a British film. Or actually, I think it's Irish. I think they're either Irish or Scottish. It was made with the Irish or Scottish money.
Okay.
One's called Dog Soldier.
Yeah.
The other one's called Le Pacte des Loups or The Brotherhood of the Wolves?
I love both of those movies.
You've seen both of them?
Oh, fuck yeah, dude.
Okay, I'm leaning toward Brotherhood of the Wolves because it's got its artistry. It's kind of in the same vein of like filmmakers pulling all the stops, being really well funded for what they're trying to accomplish. It's like every aspect of the frame, from wardrobe to set design to acting to staging and everything, is impeccable. Yep. I'm not saying Dog Soldiers isn't that, but Dog Soldiers is more of
different beast. It's a different beast.
It's a creature feature, where the other one, Brotherhood of the Wolves, is like an epic.
Yeah.
It's like an epic horror movie. Yeah. But a lot of people, when they watch it, like, this isn't a horror movie. It's like, well, it kind of is.
Plus, it's got
Mark. A beast. It's a creature feature too, but
it's got Mark Dacascos in it, who is
He's such not a, only that, the fact that he's playing a
Native American.
Native American.
Yeah.
Doing what really the research that I think the filmmakers, and then even him, or what he brought to the table, and the research that he or the filmmakers pulled into making his character not just some like caricature of an American Native American warrior of the era that this is taking place in,
right?
Like, what they could have easily, I guess, whitewashed it, and they didn't.
Yeah.
So
I think that's a great idea. So which one?
It's probably one of the best opening to any horror film I've seen, other than maybe our werewolf-ish movies that I've seen since American Werewolf in London.
But yeah, sure. All right, so what do you want to do first?
Brotherhood of the Wolves. We'll do Dog Soldiers further down the road.
Okay, that's cool. All right, so Brotherhood of the Wolf next. Sweet. Dang it. I haven't seen it in a while, but I'm looking forward to it. Cool.
Plus, Monica Bellucci.
Wow.
Fell in love with her in that movie.
And then the
world fell in love with her.
That's the other podcast, Cocktails and Dreams.
You can dream. We can dream, can't we?
All right, folks. We are out of time. Awesome episode. Really good. Cheers, brother.
Ding, ding.
I don't know. It's Zoom. We don't know which side was. Eventually, we'll have a studio, and we'll be able to do this properly. We are getting ready
for it. I will work on not overspeaking.
What's that?
I really didn't want to overspeak this time because I was really excited that you picked it, and I was really looking forward to your point of view. And as you
I really had a good time with it. Absolutely. But we are on our way to After Hours, so stay with us. And thank you all for watching, listening, wherever you're getting your podcast. Make sure you go out to anchor.fm/cocktails and screens. You can support the podcast. You can become a supporter, and we will send you out a t-shirt.
Let's support,
you know,
we need more swag, and we need people to give the swag too.
Yes So jump out there, do a $5 a month support donation to us, and we will shoot you out a t-shirt. So that is it from us. We will see you next week. I'm John Mers.
And I'm Christopher Grace.
And this has been Cocktails and Screams. Have a great night, everybody.